Zach Bennett.
Hi, I'm Zach, and I'm an ALA team. Okay, so I'll just start with where I was born. I was born in Stevenage, England on April 2nd of 2000. Shortly after I was born, I moved here where I lived with my mother and father. And so just as a kid, I was in a normal family, or what I thought was a normal family, because babies don't usually think like, oh yeah, those are my alcoholic parents. I guess like everything was pretty normal till I was about, five or six. I really noticed there was starting to be a problem when people would come into our house and I really wouldn't know who they were. I would just see, oh, dad's friend, oh, mom's friend. But really they were drug addicts coming into our house, staying mostly without our permission. They'd hide sometimes under the house and then come in at night to sleep there. And I know, like, not very inviting. But again, as a little kid, I was like, oh, sweet, friends. But so there was one night where my mother and father were arguing, and that was the night I really noticed there was actually a problem and what problems actually looked like in the household. I heard screaming, and I saw my mother and father getting into a fight and all their friends like surrounding them, trying to pull them back. And I saw my father grab my mother by the hair and throw her down the stairs. And that's like an image so clear in my mind that I can just close my eyes and see it. And it was horrific. And I really haven't looked at him the same way after that. So after that happened, we left that house and we were evicted from that house. And so we moved to a cottage, which is, I don't have many nice memories. I have one good memory of running and jumping down the stairs into the arms of one of my uncles. And so after that, my mother took me to the airport for summer. And she said, you're going on summer vacation to England with your grandparents. And she said, you'll be there for 2 months and then you'll come back and I'll be okay. And little did I know that 2 months was going to turn into 2 years. But so I was at the airport and mother and I were both crying and it was not very fun. And so I went to England and I reconnected with my grandparents and I live with them. And so ever so often my mother would call me and I would just ask to come home. I just wanted to come home. Like, I loved my life there, but it wasn't the same as this here. And she would, like, I wonder why she didn't call often. And she told me recently or a few years ago that she didn't have a place to stay, basically. And so it was hard for her to communicate with me. So we did the best we could. She had a laptop. And being the little kid I was into Club Penguin. I don't know if you guys know what that is. But it's a little game where you play like virtual penguins and we did stuff like that. And that's basically how I kept my connection. And I, just for the record here, I would usually beat her in every race. But yeah, I don't know. I liked my life there, but there's always something missing, and that something missing was my mother. I always had that, like, everlasting connection with her, because I'm a mama's boy. I'm not afraid to admit it, like, straight up. But, so, after 2 years passed there, I came home, and, I mean, I was so happy to finally come home. Because I remember running in the airport, seeing my mother and jumping into her arms, like, you know, the classic movie style stuff. And so we were living in the basement of this woman that my mother took care of upstairs. And so I thought I had it made. I had like a bunk bed. I had like 3 mini TVs, like that size. I was like, yeah, I'm living the life. And so I started school and my best friend was there. And life was going good. And then we moved into this apartment complex, which I met a lot of friends, and my mother met her sponsor in. And her sponsor, as she said, eventually like told her to bring me to Alateen when I was 9, not 10. But yeah, so she was like, you need to bring him to Alateen. And mom was like, you need to go to Alateen. I'm like, no, those are juvenile delinquents. I'm not getting influenced. Little did I know. No, I went there. And I was like, I felt just like the love sitting in that hallway at Petrit Hospital, just having an Alateen meeting. And that's where I met Elise for the first time. And a lot of other friends who, some of them I'm still in touch with. But that's where I started Alateen, at Petrit Hospital in the hallway, sitting down, talking about problems. And so life was, it had looked up, because Alateen really helped me, because I got to talk about, and I learned about a lot of stuff that was wrong, that I was very uneducated on, like alcoholism and how that's actually affected my household. And I see now that's why, like, my dad did the stuff that he did, because he was a drug addict and an alcoholic. And meanwhile, while I was in England, before I had come back, my uncle had died of alcoholism, one of my other uncles. So that was difficult, because he was like, he had something due to alcoholism, and my grandmother was so in denial that when he was in his bed and the doctor asked her, does he drink a lot? She was like, oh no, my son's perfect. Like, he would never do that. And it's debatably one of the reasons of his death. But so, yeah, life went on. And after a year, I went to NABA. And who goes to NABA here? Yeah, there we go. But that's where I started, behind a little Chinese curtain in the kitchen or lunchroom. And it was 2 to 3 Alateens every meeting with Patrick as one of our sponsors. And I remember I was like, I didn't find it weird that there was less Alateens, because it was just a good meeting in general, even though I was like 10 and all I talked about was like, oh, I lost this thing in a video game. But it still helped in a way, like, because it gets you ready for like stuff that happens in life, because a lot of people, stuff hits them in life and they don't know how to, you know, deal with it. And then, but us, we're so lucky because we have the program, and that's exactly what it's there for. And so that meeting, like, it was like a roller coaster. It went up and down in numbers. And then I remember Elise came to sponsor the meeting, and that's when it kind of like took off, because she kind of grabbed NABA by the balls and was like, look, we're getting a room, not this Chinese curtain. And I give her credit for how it is today. And we're so lucky. And yes, we have a room now, by the way. But yeah, I had gotten through middle school, and middle school was kind of tough, because I had dealt with a lot of bullying and stuff like that, because people that knew me back then was, I had hair down to here, and I had this nickname called the Mexican Girl, because one of my friends made that up, and I was like, it stuck, unfortunately. And so middle school was tough, and that's kind of where my self-esteem was at an all-time low, and that's what got me ready for high school, and like starting with low and having a low self-esteem, self-conscious about myself. At the beginning of high school, I hated myself. And 9th grade was all right. Still, people didn't like me, but I had Alateen there, and that's when really I started making the friendships that I knew was going to last, like, my whole life. Like, the people sitting right here, like, they were always there for me, and I couldn't wait for Thursday, because I knew no matter how terrible school was, I knew I would get there, and the kids there would not judge me, and they'd love me for who I am, and I get to talk about my problems, whether it's my dad's drug addiction bothering me or my homework that's not getting done. Like, they're always there for me. And 9th grade passed, and 10th grade was probably my worst year. I'm in 12th grade, by the way, now. But 10th grade is where, I don't know, I let a lot of like dark stuff get to me. I stopped going to Alateen, which I don't know why. Like, you're sad, and then you're like, oh, I don't want to go to Alateen. Or that's how I was like, that just doesn't make any sense. But I remember just, I was not in a good place, and I hated myself. And it was a lot of things just all happening at once. I would get in a lot of arguments. And I remember one assembly in Macon, I was planning on leaving early, and I was just going to leave early. And I felt like driving my car down the highway and just driving it straight off the road. I just, something in me just wanted to grab me and do that. And so I did what the program had taught me to do. And I opened up to friends who hadn't really seen that side of me. I went in a group chat with my friends, and I just straight up said, like, no sugarcoating, hey guys, I want to kill myself. And immediately they were there for me, and I felt so much love. And I felt my higher power telling me that don't leave the assembly, because if you're feeling like that, you shouldn't be driving. And so I stayed, and I was just, like, sitting there. And we went to Five Guys and ate burgers. And that's, I kind of, it lifted my mood just enough to get me home. And I, after that, I started coming to meetings more. Because for just with school and everything, it kind of gets in the way. And that's, it sucks because high school is like not fun. I'm sure you guys know that. But then after that, I started going to meetings and actually like sharing with them and with my mother of what I was feeling. And I'm blessed to have the mother that I do, because I can talk to her about some real stuff, and she's always there for me. And she's my best friend. We can get into arguments. I can be like, hey, screw you. I'm like, that's censored, by the way. And and she'll be like, hey, blank you too. I'll walk into my room. 2 minutes later, I'll come out and be like, I love you. She'll be like, I love you too. It's just how we are. But she was there for me through that, and so are my Alateens, and so are my other friends who are my real friends from school that I've talked to them about my program, and they understand, and one of them actually has a qualifier. And so 11th grade came, and that was where I started looking up. I started loving myself more. I cut out the bad people in my life, because I had a lot of people that were just downing me, and I just wanted them in my life to please myself. Like, part of me just wanted to be friends with them so I could feel good about myself. And that's when I realized I don't need other people to love myself, because I'm the only one that can change me, and I'm in control of how I feel, nobody else. And so I was like, look, I need to love myself, because that's the most important thing right now. And that's really when the light started to shine, and I was like, oh, thank you. And, yeah, like, I started getting a lot of friends that were close. Like, I don't have a huge group of friends. I have a small group that love me for who I am and that are always there for me. And that's exactly what works for me. I don't need a lot of friends to feel good about myself, because if I did, I'd be in trouble. And so the program has really helped me, because no matter what, I always know if I'm in trouble, I can call one of these people over here, or go to a meeting on Thursday, or go to the meetings on Wednesdays at Peachford, because I know that's still open. And I'm so glad that my mother dragged me by the ear into that door, because, oh my God, that it's a life changer. And it's educated me so much, and because of it, I have friends that I can call at 3 a.m. in the morning, and I know they'll answer. And it's made me a better person, too. And it's made me so, now that my friends know, they can call me at 3 a.m. in the morning and I'll answer. And it's just, it's made life better. It's made me a better person. And it's helped me love myself even more, because it's taught me so many lessons that I can't even start to repay. And I'm so grateful for everybody who led me here into this program, including, like, everybody in this room, all of you, I love all of you guys. I may not know most of you, but I love all of you. And service work. But, I knew she'd do this. I knew she'd do this.
That could be the Alabama baby.
Right? Yeah. But, yeah, I'm so excited for my future now. Because of the program, I've learned to be optimistic, and I've learned to love myself and the others around me. And it's just, I'm so excited for my future, and I can't wait to be a sponsor for Alateen. So then I can do the big boss stuff. And 30 years from now, I hope I'll still be standing up here and telling you guys my continued story. Thank you.
So I give you Hella.
Thank you, Lucy. Hi, I'm Hella. Super grateful member of Al-Anon Family Groups. And thank you to the committee. Thank you, Joy. I'm crying. I cried already before I got up here. Normally I get here and then I cry, but oh well. It's whatever. Thank you to everyone here on this lovely afternoon being inside and listening to my story. I came to Al-Anon in, I usually say January 2nd, 2005. And the way, reason I say usually is I don't know exactly what day that was. It was sometime in January, I think. I don't remember a lot. Let's just put it that way. I didn't drink, and I still don't remember a lot. I just tuned it out. Didn't like it, zip, zap, zoom, gone, memory erased. That's how I function for most of my life. I'm uncomfortable, I don't like what's happening here, erase, and it's not happening. Don't talk about it, it's not happening. I'm fine, life is good. Until it catches up with you, but you know, it works for a while. I wanted to start with a reading from Courage to Change. This is sort of where I've been, you know, noodling on this for the last year especially, really dealing with some surrender again. So I just want to read part of the reading here at the beginning and then part of this reading at the end. So this is from September 25th. I find myself taking step three over and over again. Unfortunately, I often wait until a problem starts to overwhelm me before I finally give in and turn it over to my higher power. Nevertheless, today I am striving to place my entire will and life in my higher power's hands with the willingness to accept his or her will for me no matter what. The awareness I have gained in Al-Anon lets me know that my way has seldom worked in the past. It's only when I let go and trust the inner voice that quietly nudges me in the direction of my higher power's choosing that my life becomes fulfilling. So, I've made a decision, a significant decision, at least three times in my life. The first time I was 14, and I decided, and I remember this very vividly, I was sitting in church, my parents took me to church every Sunday, and I was sitting in church, and I just quietly in the pew, like in my head, said, God, if you're actually there, which I am not so sure you are, I'm not feeling it, and so I'm going to make a decision right now that I've got this. I don't need your help. I'm going to take over. And God was like, okay, I mean, I'm not going to argue with that lady, so have at it. And why did I make that decision? Well, I think because I grew up in a home that was affected by alcoholism. There were no drinkers that I could see. My parents didn't drink. My older brother didn't really drink. My other brother he kind of drinks, whatever, something about that, but not really sure. But nobody actually was drinking. So I didn't know that I was living in an alcoholic home. But what I did know was that people didn't really talk about anything, and if they did talk about things, they talked about those things somewhere else in the house, and then just sort of emerged from a door and like informed you of a decision that was made that impacted you, but you had no participation in any of it. But mostly, we just didn't talk about anything. Nothing. I'm not even sure what we talked about, actually, now that I come back. We must have talked about something. But we didn't talk about anything that I felt was important to me. There was no space to talk about how I felt. There was no space to articulate something wasn't working for me. There was no way for me to address anything, and there was no mechanism by which I could say anything. And so because everybody else around me seemed to be doing fine with that themselves, I just thought something was wrong with me, that I had all this stuff inside and no way to express it. So I just said, okay, well, I'll do what I see, which is I'll just stuff it too. And so I would stuff it and stuff it and stuff it and recede a little bit more every day. It got to the point where when I was a teenager, and I wish I had known there was Alateen. I wish I'd known I even would qualify for Alateen. I wouldn't have known that as a teenager. But so when I was like in my teen, like 14, 15, around this time where I'm making decisions now, I'm like, God, I've got this. I was so overwhelmed with this, all this stuff I didn't know how to say or how to say to people, that I literally made myself stop breathing. So I would have asthma, which I say that in quotes because there was no physical issue. There was a mental issue that nobody wanted to talk about. But I just was like, no, I'm totally fine. I'm just going to hyperventilate myself into not breathing. But nothing to see here. It's all good. It's all good. You know, just take me to the hospital. No problem. Steroids so I can breathe again. We're good. Like, nothing, moving along. But I did that. And I remember I would do that at certain moments where I was just, like, overwhelmed. And I'm like, I can't take one more thing. And I would literally go and just stop breathing. So, you know, this family disease is a killer. Because, I mean, I could have done that one too many times. Or the ambulance could have not gotten there in time. I don't know. Anyway, that was what it looked like to make the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of me. I'll just stop breathing. And then resuscitate and then stop breathing. And, you know, anyway. My mom obviously was completely freaked out by this pattern of not breathing. You know, she didn't really know what to say about that. And so they didn't really say much. Like, it was this very large elephant in the very small room that nobody seemed to notice or talk about. So the solution instead that I came up with was, I think you should send me to boarding school. And they were like, absolutely, that's a great idea. You just go over there. And so that's when I learned, if you're uncomfortable and you can't deal with your problems, just remove yourself and go to a foreign country or somewhere. Just relocate. It's fine. Over there, wherever that may be, the problem won't exist. No one will know you, and you can start all over again. So I did that. And my parents were happy to sort of like assist in this solution, because then guess what? I was out of sight and out of mind also, and no one had to deal with it. So this is this is my preparation for life, basically. Don't talk about anything. Stuff it down. When it becomes too much, stop breathing or clear all shelves in your room, break the remote control, just have a fit, basically. Destroy all of the things in your room and then pretend like that didn't happen, carry on. And then when that all fails, move. Okay, Good. I'm prepared for life. So, most excellent. So I carry on with that. I come back. I go to boarding school. I come back. I go to college. And then I'm like, I feel like another change is required. I have been here for too long in one place. So let's move to New York, because that's where crazy lives, and I love it. So let's go right into the den of it. At this point, also, my dad had been really sick for quite some time. He was diabetic and had heart issues, and so he was slowly declining in health. And, you know, he and I were close, and, you know, there was definitely some stuff about that I would not exactly call appropriate. So, you know, I sort of didn't want to leave him in this way, in this state. And so, but I did, and I decided, okay, I needed to move on and, like, sort of start my life. But he was very ill, and I get to New York, and I'm working in the catering business, and I'm working on a large, like, this big fragrance launch event. And at this pre-planning meeting, I see this guy across the room with, like, the only way to describe it is exploding Q-tip hair, like bleached hair, like crazy patchwork leather jacket. I'm like, oh my God, who is that guy? I gotta meet that guy, because that guy has got it going on. I'm like, I can just tell. Crazy over there, crazy town. Let's go. Let's do this. So we meet, and I'm like, interesting. And so, you know, at the actual event, he came over to me and was like, "There's like nothing good to drink here, just white wine and iced tea and water." And I'm like, "Oh, hold on." So I go to scurry off to the back. And I have a box of, like, hard liquor for the VIPs. So I'm like, all right. I fill a huge tumbler of straight vodka, bring it out. I'm like, how's that? He's like, perfect. Guzzles it down. I'm like, ah, yes. Wow. Oh, I was breathless. Whoa. That was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. So I made him my boyfriend. Like, you know, he really wasn't interested. He's like, I'm like, no, really, I know what's good for you. You are now my boyfriend. And he was like, okay, I guess so. I'm like, get your U-Haul, back it up, unload. Here's my apartment. Here's a credit card, debit card, key to the place. Go. He's like, okay, I guess. I don't understand. So simultaneously to all of that, my dad passes away. And that all I can say, like, I've never heard a barbaric yelp, but that was one. I got that phone call, and it just was a noise. I don't even know how to describe that noise. And so I hung up that phone, and I sort of looked over, and I made another decision. I'm going to turn my life and my will over to him, that guy, the vodka-drinking Q-tip hair guy. That's what we're doing. I've decided. And so in that moment, I decided that, and I will now cease to exist as my own self, because my entire life's mission now is about that guy and that guy succeeding, because my life depends on him and his success and just general well-being. And it was almost that deliberate, almost that conscious. And it was just another way to escape a reality I could not bear. Couldn't bear it. I couldn't bear to be on the planet. I didn't know how to cope. I didn't know how to function. I didn't know how to talk about myself. I didn't know how to do much of anything except plan and strategize. And that I could do very well. So I'm like, well, if that's what I know how to do, I don't want to learn how to do anything else. I'll just do that. So I spent quite some years perfecting that art. And I can't say that it was all terrible. Some of it was a lot of fun. We got engaged. He didn't want to go through with it. I told him, oh, you'll be fine. We're totally... Don't worry, I'm like, pull over that bar stool. Let me talk to you here for a second. You can do this, buddy. You can do this. Because I had a dress ordered, and I am not going to tell nobody that the invitations are, you know, false and called off. No. Oh, no, no. This crazy is not just on the inside. Right, Joy? So, you know, he was like, okay, poor guy. I mean, he has, you know, he helped, but I'm just saying, like, he was, had no chance. No chance. So, you know, we got married. I made sure we had plenty of booze at the wedding because, God forbid, we might run out, you know. It was a lot of drinking at that wedding. Whew. And I wasn't drinking, but I was just like walking through like a deer in headlights, like I don't even know what's happening to me. And that was sort of a metaphor for life. But anyway, so we spent quite a few years this way. Like, we got married, total madness, and then we were in the entertainment business at this point. I had decided it would be a really good idea for me to be his manager and his PR representative. I did that. So it was literally my job to, like, you know, manage his image to everybody. And I was pretty good at it. So we went on tour and we were like flying here, flying there, you know, doing live shows and, you know, all, it's just nuts. And everywhere we went, it was sort of this general pattern. We would get there. We would settle in, then the drinking would start, and then halfway through the evening, we'd be like screaming at each other, and now somebody's going to get a divorce. One of us is asking the other for a divorce, sometimes both of us simultaneously. Then we're going to talk about that whole night, about how we should go about that, and if we should really get divorced, maybe we shouldn't get divorced. I don't know, maybe... And then morning would come, and we'd be like, all right, so what are we doing today? And we would do that the next night, and the next night, and the next night. And we would go into these foreign, exotic locations, screaming and fighting all night long. I mean, there was a waiter in Paris who was just like, I'm not sure I want to go back to that table. Like, these people are crazy. He's like, do you want dessert? No! We're like, go away! I'm busy yelling at him, don't you see? So, anyway... here I am, I'm like, run away from the family, he's my higher power, and it's all insanity. And I'm like, let's bring mom along for all these trips, too. So my mom's like, you know, on the road with us and alternatingly, like, traveling with us and just witnessing all of this madness. And, she, you know, I'd look over sometimes and she'd be sitting on a rock, like doing like a yoga pose. And I'm like, really? Like, how does that lady, she's so zen, you know, but she's like, I'm over it. You people are crazy. I'm going to be over here meditating. And, you know, that was her way of dealing with it. Nope, not happening. But, you know, so we just kind of did that for a few years. And, you know, I didn't think anything of it. I didn't think any of this was unmanageable. You know, one time we had a doorknob in our New York apartment, very small, and so the bathroom is basically in the kitchen. It's not uncommon. It's like a little wall there, and then a sort of a door, but it's dicey if it's a different room. And so the doorknob broke off because, you know, that's what happens when there's lots of drinking and drugs happening in the apartment. And so, you know, we just left it that way. Like, okay, there's no doorknob. Whatever. And then we always had people over. We weren't the kind of household where we didn't want you to come see the crazy. Like, we're like, no, really, come over for dinner. Have a seat, you know, no doorknob on the bathroom door. So one night we had people coming over, and I'm like, oh, no, we don't have a doorknob in there still. And so we had some tangerines sitting there, so I just grabbed a tangerine, stuck it in the doorknob hole. I'm like, done, doorknob. And then the tangerine would sort of rot. Put a new one in there. There was a hole in the wall. I think he punched it at one point, you know. I mean, and this was the sort, right? So it was all funny until it wasn't funny, right? And so, and even then it wasn't like I noticed it, which is scary, right? I didn't notice that it had gone from funny to not funny in the sense that, like, so, like, you know, now we're not just screaming at each other. Now I'm getting right up in his face. Now I'm poking at him. And he's going, oh, really? And he's poking back. And then next thing you know, I'm like, I'm just going to kick you. And then he's like, oh, really? I'm just going to punch you in the back of your head. So, you know, it sort of progresses, right, from funny, ha-ha, tangerine in the doorknob, which was really quite funny, I have to say, to, right, little by slow, I'm going to hit you a little harder. I'm going to hit you a little more often. And then on top of it, I was talking about this earlier today. My special skill was I will dagger you with a verbal assault that you don't even know is about to hit you, and it comes out of nowhere because I'll take it, and I won't say anything. And then out of the blue, I will say the one thing that will most likely destroy you, like an assassin. And and you know, and he would tell people, she's mean to me. And they were like, oh, please, not Hella. Look at her, she's so sweet. And I'm like, yes. I'm so sweet. And they didn't know, right? They didn't say, because I didn't show them that stuff. So, I mean, I was pretty awful to him for, you know, and he tried to ask for help, and no one, they were like, whatever, because he was crazy on the outside. Right, a whirling dervish, like crazy mania, obviously crazy, drinking and this and that and loud and all over the place. It was obvious to everyone that something wasn't quite right there or that it was out of control. I, meanwhile, was just sort of standing there managing all of this, and they had no idea that I was crazy on the inside. And I wasn't telling anyone that stuff. So anyway, we flash forward, and you know, finally, like, I was at one point I was working at an entertainment lawyer's office, and I get a phone call in the middle of my workday, and he's like, "I'm standing in Home Depot, and I'm looking at rope," which I'm like, "Code word for you're going to hang yourself. Thanks for calling. Have a nice day." Like, what? Like, you know, and I mean, I've had so many of these phone calls where I'm in the middle of life, right? And I'm doing just my normal day, and I get this phone call, and the person's telling you something so insane that you're like, how do I even process this completely insane thing of, like, I'm standing in Home Depot looking at rope, and you're sitting at work in Manhattan, like, an hour commute away or something like that, like powerless. So there's nothing. What am I going to do with that? What am I supposed to do with that? It's crazy making. It is crazy making. So, you know, I don't even know what I said. I don't remember what I said, but I just said, okay, like, because I'm trying to pretend, like, to my coworkers, it's an open floor plan, that everything is perfectly fine here. And so I'm like, nope, you can't let them see this. So I'm like, okay, and I just hang up, and I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to come home to later tonight. I've got, like, 6 more hours in my workday, and I have no idea what it's going to be like when I get home. So that was also the day in and day out. Anyway, at some point he did get sober. And part of, you know, the big part of my story is that, you know, my husband got sober and then not sober and then sober and then not sober and then not sober and then maybe sober, not sober. I don't know. Anyway, many, many times. And it was in one of his I'm sober moments where I, you know, I was like, he stopped drinking and I'm still crazy. And so he would go, he was going to meetings and I would literally follow him to every AA meeting. I was like, I'm going to follow, make sure he goes. And then I'm going to make sure what he does after he leaves. And then while he's there, I'm going to listen to how he's sharing so I know how he's doing, because that'll tell me if he's having a good day or a bad day, right? Like, like crazy. Nothing has changed for me, except now I'm monitoring his sobriety, not his drinking. So he's just like in a meeting, trying to have a meeting, I guess. And his eventually his sponsor comes up to me and he's like, listen, lady, I love you, but you need to go to Al-Anon. And I'm like, psst, I don't want to go there. I don't mean these people. I don't like them. He's like, you don't even know them. I don't care. They don't seem like they're very fun. And like, I mean, I just want to come here and like sit in your meeting. And he's like, no, go to your own meeting and leave him alone. He needs to be here and be here by himself without you. And so I was like, fine. So I went to, fine. So I finally went to an Al-Anon meeting. I mean, I tried everything else, right? I went to a drug and alcohol counselor. I didn't even do drugs or really drink at this point. But I'm going to go to a drug and alcohol counselor for this problem I have. Because really, I'm going for his problem. Because I, remember, I have not made any other decisions yet. My life and my will are still in the care of this guy. So everything, my well-being is riding on whether he gets sober and stays sober and how he does it. So, you know, I just was like, I don't really want to go to Al-Anon, but fine. So I go, and I'm sitting in my first meeting, and I just go, these people are talking about things. What is this? And why are they doing that? That seems wholly inappropriate. And like they're just freely discussing the most terrible things, and they're freely talking about their emotional state, and they're freely sharing about their fears and concerns about life and what they're doing about them. And I'm like, what is this language? What is this? I had no frame of reference for that. So I just sat there, and then I left. And then I came back the next week, and I just sat there, and then I left. And I came in just a little bit too late, and I left just a little bit too early because I didn't want you to talk to me. But then I also got mad because you didn't talk to me. So I was like, you know what? These people are not very nice, and they're very rude, and they won't even say hi to me, but I'm going to leave a few minutes early, and I'm going to come a few minutes late. So I did that for a while. I did that for like 2 years. And then there was a point where I thought I probably should get a sponsor. Some people keep talking about the sponsor. Oh, and I was doing service. I like ran the newcomers meeting. Steps 1, 2, and 3. And I'm like, I will now teach you about step 1. And they let me. I'm like, they let me. I don't know. No one said, you can't do that. So anyway, so I'm sitting there, and I'm like, I think I might need to get this thing they call a sponsor. My husband has one. It seems to be working for him. And my marriage is not doing so great. So I think maybe I should get a sponsor. So I asked, I'm not kidding, at least 20 people, and they all said no. They all said, no, I can't. I mean, they were like, oh, I'm too busy. Oh, I'm already sponsoring one other person. And some part of me is like, seriously? I'm dying over here. And you won't effing sponsor me? So I was really growing despondent. I mean, I went to every meeting I could think of, and I asked every person that remotely looked like they had something of use, like they could help me, right? I didn't even know what I wanted at this point. Like, just somebody help me with these steps. And so, I was growing despondent, and I was getting to a point, like, my marriage was really disintegrating. I knew there was something I needed to be doing for myself, but I didn't know what. I had all this head knowledge. I had read How Al-Anon Works from front to back and back to front and underlined and memorized. I mean, I read The Daily Reader, The Courage to Change, and I was not getting any better. I was still feeling crazy and despondent, and I had gotten to a place where I was terrified to speak. I was terrified I couldn't even figure out anymore who I was, what I liked. I didn't know what kind of clothes I liked, what kind of color I liked, what food I liked. I had sort of like fallen. And, you know, because he's my higher power. And I knew I needed to do something about that, but I didn't know how to do it by myself. And I knew that I couldn't. So I spent about 6 months, every night I would pray, God, and I didn't even know that I believed in God at this point, but I was just like, well, whatever, God, I really don't want to wake up tomorrow because I cannot do one more day like this. I can't do it. I can't do it. I don't want to do it, and I can't do it. Please don't let me wake up. Please. And I would wake up, and I was like, ugh. Gotta be kidding me. I'm awake. Okay, great. So I would get up and I would get put on clothes and I would go to work. I mean, I was showing up. But like a zombie. Like I was, and I'm in recovery, right? I'm in Al-Anon, so to speak. Second year in, zombie. No joy, wanting to die. And nobody will sponsor me. So February of 2007, I'm sitting in my home group, the one that I did the beginners meeting for, and I hear this lady, it's anniversary night, and I hear this lady tell her very brief version of her story. And she's laughing and so happy and like energetic, and I'm like, what? Who is that? Like, I've never seen this before. And her story is terrible. I mean, this woman has endured things that I'm like, I don't even have a clue what that must have been like. So after that meeting, I made a beeline to the front. And there were all these people standing around her. And I'm like, oh, no, no. You are not getting her as your sponsor. Because I need a sponsor and that lady is going to be my sponsor. So I like elbowed people out of the way. I'm like, I don't care. Like, that is it. I am done with you. And like, get out of my way. So I get to her and I'm like, you know, yes, will you be my sponsor? And she's like, here's my number, call me in the morning. And I'm like, okay. So I call her in the morning. I'm like, okay, will you be my sponsor? And so then she's like, here's what you're going to do. You're going to call me every day for 30 days. You're going to go to at least 3 Al-Anon meetings. You're going to pick one of those Al-Anon meetings to be your home group. You're going to get a service position at that home group. And then you're going to start reading that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous so that you can learn what the disease of alcoholism actually is. And I'm like, okay. So I did all those things. I called her every day for 30 days. She also did a book study, started working the steps with me right away. So it was maybe July. So not very long after, I was in my third step. And the way she had me work the third step is I did the third step prayer from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous every day for 30 days. And if I missed a day, I had to start over. I did not miss a day. I did not. I was so desperate. The same desperate drive that made me pray for death every night, that made me ask 20 people to sponsor me, and even though everyone said no, I kept asking. That same, like, ultimate drive that God put in me, I was like, I am so willing, I will do whatever this lady tells me. And so I did not miss a day. I did every assignment, like, and not like sort of like, I mean, I did that thing because I knew that my life depended on it. that I didn't have a choice anymore. I didn't have the luxury of like wandering around, sort of doing this thing. I'd been doing that for 2 years. It did not work for me. It wasn't getting any better. It was getting worse. So I did my third step, in the middle of my third step, and my husband comes home, and he's like, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to leave. And I looked at him and I said, well, now that you've said that, you have to go. What? Like, who said that? That was me. Me. I didn't go, no, let's talk about it, right? Like, I made him my boyfriend. I convinced him he could marry me. He married, right? I did it like every other time. I was like, no. Like, but now I had made a different decision, right? I had made the decision to turn my life and my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him, not him anymore. That doesn't mean I didn't take it back many, many times. And it doesn't mean that I have done that perfectly. But that was a deciding moment where I realized that my care wasn't coming from anybody but God. That God had me and was going to take care of me, and that I would be perfectly fine and happy, joyous, and free no matter what I had in my life or didn't have, as long as God was my source. I knew that right then, and I just knew it. I didn't have to figure it out. I didn't have to analyze it. I just knew it. And so I simply said what was true. Since you said that, you now have to go. And he knew I meant, like, I was talking about this with my sponsor the other day. When you say something that you truly mean to somebody, they know the difference between you just kind of saying something and you telling them the truth. And he knew it. He was like, oh, crap, this may have backfired. Not sure that was advisable. She's serious. She's not trying to argue with me. What is this weird behavior? So anyway, he did leave, and we were separated for a year and a half. And in that time, I went all over the place with my sponsor. And in fact, it was the first time I came to Atlanta. It was in 2007 to a women's retreat weekend in November, and I've been coming to that same weekend ever since. I only missed 1 year, which was, it couldn't be avoided, but and I'll get into that one in a second. But anyway, I haven't missed it. I've never lived in Atlanta, but the most important people in my recovery live here. My sponsor lives here. My closest, bestest friends in Al-Anon live here. Like, all the, like, people that I trust with my life live in Atlanta, and I've never lived here. It's pretty cool. That's the power of the 12 steps. If you're willing, you don't know where your recovery family will come from. You don't know what it will look like. If you just are willing and you show up and you're happy to just, and you're open-minded about it, anything is possible. I mean, what are the odds of that? Seriously, like, that is weird. I've never lived here and all my friends are here, so. And then some of them who have moved from here, we do a bi-weekly Skype meeting. And I've never even met half those people in person. It's amazing. I'm like, I don't know, we're just meeting now on Skype. Go technology. So, you know, it's pretty incredible. Any case, my sponsor had me going all over the place, and I just followed her. I didn't even know half the time where I was going. I went to Illinois. I went to this place, that place, this convention, that conference. I was like service maniac. I was running around, like, area service, group rep, intergroup rep, intergroup board. I mean, I was like, any position, I don't recommend. Some of that was a little bit, I went, whoa, way overboard. But you know what? It got me out of the house. It got me among people. It got me busy. I wasn't thinking about him when I was busy doing service. And it just mainly, it got me out of the house because I had been spending years sitting on my couch worrying. I thought that was an actual activity, right? I'm going to sit here and worry for the next 3 hours. I did something today, everybody. I worried for 3 hours. It felt legit. So I'm like, I'm too busy to sit in my couch and worry. I'm busy running around, driving to this place, that place. taken the train, whatever. So anyway, a year and a half after that, we did get back together. He was not sober at the time, and I made that decision to get back together with him, even though at that time he was not sober. I don't know. What can I say, right? It's true. So, and, you know, I think that, you know, and I mean, I did a lot of writing about it, and I prayed about it, and that was the answer I got. Whether it was the right answer or an honest answer, I can't tell you. It was as honest as I could be at the time. Let's put it that way. So, you know, we've kind of muddled through in terms of that, like, for, you know, several years, and he's, you know, he's had his own journey, and increasingly I've learned how to let him have his, how to not just let him, but really, like, understand he has his own journey. It's not the same journey as mine. It's going to look completely different. You know, he hasn't had a drink in almost 6 years now. Yeah, 6 years. And, you know, he hasn't been going to AA meetings for like 2 or 3 years. He just now got a sponsor again. I don't even know what any of that means. But you know what? I'm staying out of it. And because I'm staying out of it, I'm not taking it on. It's not my responsibility. I love him. You know, I've been to many open AA meetings. My sponsor had me go to tons of open AA meetings, especially early on when I was like, but why can't he stay sober? What? Right? And I would go to meetings and I would hear alcoholics tell their story and I would understand it wasn't him doing that to me. It was the disease of alcoholism that had him in its grips and he could not find a way to stay sober. And whatever that means or doesn't mean, it had nothing to do with me. And it didn't mean that he didn't love me or that he didn't care, but he was incapable at different times of telling me the truth. He just couldn't have, right? But I didn't know that. And if it hadn't been for open AA meetings, speaker meetings in particular, where I could hear, you know, AAs, not my husband, tell their stories, and I could really understand and really detach with love and really appreciate what this disease is for an alcoholic and for myself. My solution wasn't to drink, but, I mean, we all, I think, are pretty much on the same page now, right, that, woo, crazy town over here, my thinking was so distorted and so out of whack that, like, I had to find a solution. My solution just didn't come in the form of a drink or a drug. My solution came in the form of people and running away. Run away. Or stop breathing or some other bizarro solution. So anyway, I mean, he's on his spiritual path. It doesn't look the way I would like it to look, maybe. It doesn't look like the one that works for me, but it seems to be working for him. And that's all I know. So anyway, 2010, we have the bright idea. Again, discomfort strikes. So let's move to New Mexico. I don't know why. I don't know. Let's live on the mountaintop. What? You know, we live in New York City, have done for almost 20 years, and let's go to the country. But not just, like, the country, like the mountains in the middle of nowhere. So that was sort of literally wandering in the desert for 4 years. But, you know, I did make some really amazing friends out there. I was super involved in Al-Anon there. So now, guess what? I have a whole Al-Anon family in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And they're wonderful and fabulous. But that was ill-advised. While we were there and before, you know, it was ill-advised because it wasn't what God wanted for me. It was my solution. It was my solution one more time. Even though, right, I had this great third step experience, I understood. Didn't matter. I was still making decisions based on self or based on what would make him more comfortable still. So we move to New Mexico, and he gets really badly injured there in a work situation. And so in 2014, and so 2014, now mind you, I've sort of done everything I could, which is why you haven't heard much about them, to avoid my family, basically. I couldn't deal with them. These people don't know how to talk to each other. Very judgy on my part. right? And I think also I was doing the best I could to just sort of like get some skills, some life skills, and being able to function that I couldn't be around them. It just couldn't do it. And so, and I just had no hope that there would ever be some sort of change in that relationship. I mean, I kept in touch with my mom. My mom visited us a lot when we lived in New York. So, she wasn't, like, cut out or anything. But, like, you know, it was very much on my terms, this relationship. And, you know, once I got into recovery, my sponsor did have me call her on a regular basis. Like, every week I called her, no matter where I was, and I just to say hi and I love you and all of that. But so basically, you know, it's 2014. I've been living in New Mexico for 4 years where, you know, it'd been a really hard time. And because it's a difficult place to get back and forth to, and my mom couldn't be at altitude, so I really hadn't seen her much in 4 years. And so anyway, the still small voice, and my husband's like basically in bed with a brain injury and a neck fusion, a blown neck. And it turns out to be a failed fusion surgery. So I'm like back in step one. I'm hating this guy right now. You bleepity bleep bleep like ruined my life by getting injured. Didn't have any, you know, wasn't his fault. Really wasn't his fault. But, you know, it's irrational. It's step one. I feel powerless, so I'm going to just, it's all your fault. My misery now, all your fault. Anyway, in the midst of all this insanity, I get this still small voice that says, "Go home now." Now, if there's one thing I've learned is when you hear something like that, you listen, but quick. And so I was like, and I call my sponsor. I'm like, seriously, I've got this guy in bed. I've got this job situation that, you know, my family. There was a family business with a job situation, but, you know, and I'm like, I mean, but this is nuts, right? I mean, with everything going on, move across country. And we talked it through, and, you know, they were going to pay for the move. They were going to send packers who packed and moved, right? So really, there wasn't all that much to do, relatively speaking. And so I just said, we're doing it. And we got back to Virginia in September of 2014, and my mom, you know, happened to work where we were living. She would work there once a day, once a week, so she decided, I'm going to spend every Tuesday when I'm up there for work at your house and sleep over. I'm like, okay, like I got voluntold, as I like to say. She voluntold that I was going to have her as my house guest every Tuesday. So she did, and so every Tuesday she came over and we would have dinner together, she, my husband, and I, and then she would spend the night, and then I would go to work in the morning. She, my husband, would have breakfast. Like, so cute. I mean, they were both kind of like hobbling. He was sort of hobbling, and she was also dealing with some back pain, so she was kind of hunched over. So the two of them would shuffle around and have breakfast together. And then, you know, they were like healing buddies. And, I mean, so beautiful. And then she would drive home. And we did this every week for a year. And then a year later, she had to get some heart surgery, heart valve replacement surgery. And it was fairly routine, still risky, but fairly routine. And she went into the surgery, and she didn't come out. And I remember sitting in the hospital waiting room thinking, this is not a good sign. It's been like 8 hours. This operation is supposed to take 3. And I don't remember if my husband told me this or my sponsor. It's all a bit of a blur. But one of them, maybe even both of them, said to me in that time frame, that during those 8 hours, Hella, just say to God, if I'm the one in her way from going home, take me out of the way. And I heard that, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to do that. And I did that, and then she passed. I don't know that it was because I said the prayer, but I knew that energetically I had to get out of her way, right? Out of God's way. Now, you know, that's the only year I didn't get to come in November, because her funeral was right around that weekend, and I was like, call my sponsor, I'm like, so I guess I'm not coming, right? Like, is there any way I could still come this year? He's like, no, you've got family in town, funeral. I'm like, oh yeah, okay. Just checking, because this is so important to me. My recovery is so important to me, and these things, these commitments that I have are so important to me. Because they are the lifeline to me. They're like, they're my God with skin on. I have a God that I can do business with, but I also have people that I can use to sort of intermediate, you know, as intermediaries with me and God, right? We can sort of just give each other hugs for one. Anyway, so it didn't really hit me right away. It took some time to percolate, but boy, was I mad at God after that. Really mad. I had just come home, right? After wandering around in the universe, avoiding my mom and the rest of my family. And I had just gotten home, and we were just getting to a place where, like, this was like a new normal, and we were going to buy a house that she could live in with us, and like, it was all on one floor, right? We were in contract, then she went to surgery, you know, that was all over. So at some point in that proceeding, I decided I couldn't trust God anymore. And I decided that I just couldn't trust him. And so I went into this darkness that I couldn't even tell you I was in. I didn't do it on purpose. I didn't even, because I was still showing up, right? I was still calling my sponsor. I was still working my program. I was still going to all my meetings. I had a sponsee. I mean, I was, you know, I was in it. And thank God, I was still in it, and I was just showing up like a zombie, but different than the last time I was a zombie, but just sort of like, okay, I got to do this one day at a time, and eventually it will lift. And then finally, in January, so I'm in a lot of discomfort, though. So what do I know how to do when I'm in discomfort? Get away. So last October, and this is sort of the thing that's been why I had that reading in the beginning. So last October, a friend of mine in New York was like, hey, shiny, shiny things over here. Look over here. Shiny, shiny. I want you to have work for me and do blah, 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 blah. Sounded very exciting. Certainly more exciting than my ho-hum life, where it was just dealing with me and healing some things that I have not healed. And I was like, yes, I will come. So she's like, well, when my maternity leave is up in March, I'll call you. I call my sponsor, tell her all about it. She's like, mm-hmm. And I was like, that's code. I know it's code. She's like, here, I want you to do this writing assignment. I'm like, okay, I do the writing assignment. I call her about it, and I'm like, listen. Before I even read it to her, I'm like, listen. I know what this writing assignment's going to say. I'm going to do it anyway. She's like, okay, whatever. Like, fine, I know. But the weirdest thing happened. I didn't just do it. I literally sat on my hands. Something in me knew, if you do this, Hella, if you do this one more time, you will never heal the thing that is most in your way from living the full life that God has for you. And that thing was this very, very, very old idea that it's bad for me to feel good. And I have been avoiding dealing with that old idea and what the implications of that old idea in my life are for 44 years on the planet until this year. So I just strangely was like, everything in me was like, move, move, run away. And I didn't go anywhere. I just sat there. And then did the steps again. sponsor had me do the steps in a different book this time than I had ever before, and it's been awesome. Because I'm like, oh, it's a whole new experience of something I have already done, right? So we've been going through the steps. Step one, I had this whole list of things I'm powerless over. I'm like, I didn't even know I was still trying to have power over these things. I know better, quote unquote, right? And then step two, step three came, and I was like, wow. And then what I realized in the last few weeks is the real issue was I did not trust God. And my sponsor said this most amazing thing to me after we did my fifth step. She said, Hella, God is the only one who has no other agenda than your best interest. Everybody else has some kind of agenda, whether they know it or not, but God has no other agenda but your best interest. That, I've been noodling on that ever since. I mean, I'm like, what? Like, what if I replaced my old idea with that idea? What if I lived every day based on the idea that God has only one thing in his mind for me, and that is my best interest and my well-being and everything else, who cares? Wow. What a freedom. It also means that my circumstances, do not need to define my reality. Because I have a recovery, that I can have joy even when things are difficult. I can have joy even when I'm so uncomfortable, I want to zipper open this skin suit and crawl out of it and just be like, oh my God, right? I can still have joy despite my circumstances. So I want to just close with that because I think that, oh, and back on the sponsorship thing, Don talked about this last night, and he mentioned it again earlier today. And based on my experience of asking no less than at least 20 people to sponsor me and everybody saying no, what I do when I'm in a meeting is I see a newcomer, I beeline right on over to them. And I just give them a hug. And then you know what I do? I don't just give them my number, I get their number. And then I call that person once a week for 4 weeks. They may never call me back. Sometimes, usually they don't. They're freaked out. They're like, what the hell? Like, why is this lady calling me? Good Lord. And I just call and say hi. Love you. You know. Bye. But, you know, today, you know, my mom and I had a great last year together. And thank God I listened to that still small voice. That's what that was about. God did have my best interest at heart. He didn't ever say for how long this was going to work, right? But he just said, go now. And I listened and I went and I had an amazing year with her. And so much got healed in that year. And she knew I loved her and I knew she loved me. So anyway, I'm going to end it with the reminder, today's reminder from that September 25th reading, sort of cap off this surrender piece. Today's reminder, is there an area in my life that I treat as though it were too important to turn over to a higher power? Are my efforts to control that area making my life better and more manageable? Are they doing any good at all? I can hold on to my will until the situation becomes so painful that I am forced to submit, or I can put my energy where it can do me some good right now and surrender to my higher power's care. And the quote from Martin Luther is, I have held many things in my hands and have lost them all, but whatever I have placed in God's hands, that I still possess. Thank you very much for letting me share.